Global health inequity is rising. Climate change, migration, and COVID have exacerbated long-standing problems, not just between countries, but within them. If the causes are man-made, the solutions must be too. Business, including the global pharmaceutical industry, not only has a responsibility in promoting health equity, it has a big financial interest to do so as well. I'm Georgie Frost, and this is the So What from BCG.
Health equity is not about charity anymore. It's not philanthropy. It's a necessity for us to continue to live the lives that we want to live. Just because our economies are so interconnected, we need all of the people to be able to fully live their lives to their full potential to contribute to the economy.
Today, I'm talking to Johanna Benesti, Global Sector Lead at BCG for Global Health.
So just to frame it, we're talking of inequities between countries, like high-income countries, low-income countries, and also inequities between groups in a given country. So maybe groups that are different because of ethnicity or gender or geographies or things like that. And the challenge that we're facing is that it's often less profitable and also more complex, so two dimensions at the same time, to address these markets. So they become the last ones on the priority list for any private sector company. That's even for a... It's funny if you think of it, but the way we classify some of those diseases, we have a category that's called neglected tropical diseases. So it tells you a lot about, you know, the fact that some are neglected. So I can give you some examples of that complexity. When we talk about fragmentation, for instance, the first one, if you think of Africa, people often think of Africa as one big homogeneous market. But in fact, it's many different countries with many different regulations and different distributor networks and different health system structures and different languages. And so if you want to address Africa, in fact, you really have to address 54 different countries and understand 54 different situations. And so that has a sort of transaction cost that you don't have when you address larger or more homogeneous markets. The second is really the experience or the expertise, because addressing those markets is quite different from the general markets. Like between the laboratory where the product is conceived and the patient who will actually use the product, there are many, many steps needed that, you know, manufacturers, regulators, CMOs, distributors, etc., will have to work on to ensure the supply. That's one thing. But there are also many, many steps that healthcare professionals, patients, implementers will have to work on and ensure so that there is demand for that product. So working, you know, with many actors on the supply side and many actors on the demand side. And that is a very specific expertise for those particular markets. That's why in the middle of this chain, you have international organizations helping. The first one that comes to mind is Unitaid. What Unitaid does, because I think it's a good example of how to address this kind of challenges, is that they identify innovative products that would help accelerate progress to some of the disease that and the epidemics that they're tackling, like tuberculosis, HIV, malaria. So they identify those innovations and they work with their partners to fund actions to remove those barriers to access one after the other. And removing that means, for instance, bringing the scientific evidence that you would need to write the right guidance, forecast, developing forecasts to encourage manufacturers to set up the right manufacturing capacities, supporting the development of operational guidelines to make sure that there will be implementation. It could be agreements with generic players, etc. A number of things that are very diverse along this chain, just to name a few.
But this is more than just access to medicine, because you can put drugs into a country, but if you don't have the professionals there and the education to know how to use those, to implement those, then it's not useless, but it's you're not going to get the full benefit.
Absolutely. So that's a super good point. So if you realize that, for instance, the issue is that people don't get access to the diagnostic, you can wonder, why don't they get access to the diagnostic? Well, maybe because the way we're thinking of the product relies on an understanding of the health system that is not common across all settings. Let me take an example, a simple one. If someone has HIV in a high-income setting, you would go to a specialist doctor that would look at what HIV type you have and define the exact cocktail drug that you need to better fit your specific disease and have the right treatment for you. If we were to do that in low-resource settings, where we don't have the same ratio of healthcare professionals, you know, having 15 years of training in infectiology for each individual, then the wait lines would be so long, you would never get the treatment. So
The thing that I mentioned before, when I said like over 15 years, we've managed to put so many people on treatment on HIV, it was a combination of three things. It was working on the price and introducing generics. That's one. It was standardizing the treatment so that in fact, in low resource settings, there is a standard first line course that you get. The treatment protocol has been simplified so that we could scale up more easily. So a healthcare professional will say, if you have that disease, then this is the treatment that you get immediately. You wouldn't have to be referred to a super specialized doctor. And the third thing is the fixed dose combination. You know, it's all pills in one because that makes it much more convenient for the patient to take. So you see, it's a change in the protocol. It's a change in the price and the full manufacturing setup. And it's a change in the product itself. If you're serious about health equity and making a difference in the access, you have to embed it from the beginning in the design of your product and not just as an afterthought. It will require to change your product, to change your approach to care, and then, of course, enable, you know, unlock all of the barriers after that.
How do you do that? How do you bake that into your design of a product? Who do you need to talk to? How do all the parts of this jigsaw need to fit together?
It's clearly a part that is very difficult because you need to get close to the end users. You know, design thinking and all of those theories that we're using, you can apply that to pharma in a way. So who are the end users? The end users are going to be the patient, are going to be the healthcare workers around that patient. The patient, you have to take into account that we might be speaking of someone who has other conditions. Someone who is immunodepressed, for instance. In some countries, HIV prevalence is super high. So you need to bear that in mind, like TB HIV co-infection, for instance. It means that people are on treatment already. So you need to manage drug-drug interactions. It could be, for instance, pregnant women. In Africa, in a lot of places, the fertility rate is about like 4 per woman. So that means that you're breastfeeding or pregnant for, you know, a significant part of your adult life. So if you have products that are not valid for children or for pregnant or breastfeeding women, then you exclude a significant share of the population. So think of who is going to use that product and make sure that you have the clinical trials and that you have a product that works for those, you know, specific groups. Then the other thing you need to think of is, how is that person going to use the product? For instance, when we were doing focus groups in Uganda, people were telling us, I'm not taking my medicines because I have to take them at noon, and it means I have to take them in front of my colleagues. If I do that, it means that I'm disclosing my status to people around me, and it's not something that I'm willing to do. I don't want to have that conversation. You've had examples of people, of children, for instance, having to take drugs for multidrug-resistant tuberculosis, a handful of pills that they have to swallow every morning. Well, kids don't swallow every morning a handful of pills. That's just a nightmare. It doesn't happen. So you need disposable formulations. So you need to fix those combinations. You need to rethink all of that to make sure that the people who need to take that product will take it. So a number of things in the end user perspective. Then you also have the healthcare practitioner perspective, because sometimes it's going to be a remote setting. It's going to be a mobile setting, for instance. We've had that in high-income countries quite a lot, that if you want to reach specific groups of population, you can't be sitting in your super sophisticated lab and wait for people to come to you. It's actually better to be in a mobile clinic or something. But that means that the equipment that you need to conduct those tests have to be different. Think of the COVID self-test that we have right now. It's much more convenient to be able to do it at home than to have to book an appointment to a lab or stand in the line in a lab. Exactly as you would do for a consumer product, think of the end user, and end user being the healthcare practitioner or the patient, and try to understand what the frictions are for those persons to be in demand for the product.
What's in it for every part? And let's start with a big global pharma company. What's in it for them to put money and investment into research and development, perhaps into medicines that really a high-income country doesn't need?
The people who don't have access to health medicines in the future are a new market. People who don't have access to health products right now are a new market for those pharmaceutical companies. Now, the question is, how do you make that market a sustainable business model? And how do you make it profitable to the level of profit that you're willing to accept, something like this. I think a while ago, people were very much in the idea that access was a matter of charity with a philanthropy. And so the main actions that pharmaceutical companies would be willing to go for would be donations, for instance, or trying to reduce the prices. And that would be the focus of what they would do. Experience from improving access in low middle income countries and and around COVID has shown that it's not just that. There's much more that you can do. Why would you want to do it? So health equity is not about charity anymore. It's not philanthropy. It's a necessity for us to continue to live the lives that we want to live. Just because our economies are so interconnected, we need all of the people to be able to fully live their lives to their full potential to contribute to the economy. You've seen over Christmas that people were panicked because there would be shortage of the products that they would want to buy for Christmas. Why that? Because of the disruptions in supply chain. Why that? Because in some parts of the world, people couldn't be at work the way that we expected them to be. And that's because they were sick. And that because they didn't have access to the products that would, you know, help them to not be sick. So just because of the level of interconnections between our economies, we're all in this together. And we have to all be super healthy and be able to live our healthy lives to contribute to that economy. So that's a necessity for the lives that we want to live and for the sort of level of comfort that we are seeking for. If that was not an argument, a sufficient argument, I can say it's also an opportunity from a commercial standpoint, because it's a new market, an additional market that companies can extend. Interestingly, now with the use of data science, for instance, we're able to look at the patient journey. Imagine a sort of cascade from all the people who have a disease and then the people who are aware of the disease, the people who get the treatment, the people who stay on treatment, and then the people who are cured. Along those steps, you're losing some patients. With advanced analytics and all the data that we have now, we can understand the complexities of the patient journey and understand exactly where we're losing patients. And there is a lot of appetite from private sector, public sector, to understand where we're losing patients so that we can have actions that are triggered to really address those specific points. So is it because the diagnostic test was not available? Is it because the patients are too far from the center? Is it because the treatment was delayed? Is it because the treatment is so inconvenient that people don't adhere to it? With the data, you can start understanding that, and then you can address it specifically, whether it's going to be by commercial action, education action, changes in your product, changes in the regulatory space, a number of things, but that will help you unlock new markets in the end and expand access to health products for patients. So more patients being on the treatment and having access to the products they need.
What role do public bodies, do governments, do global healthcare bodies have to play in all of this? Because it brings to mind the discussions around COVID and a fourth vaccine when there are countries in the world that haven't even received theirs. And you spoke about the fact that we are so interconnected. Does the messaging need to be better, I guess, from governments and global bodies as to why it is so important to sort out health inequality?
Yes, and I think the message is shifting from a question of fairness, and fairness speaks to charity and philanthropy, to a question of really necessity. It's not health for all just because it's the right thing to do. That should be a sufficient argument, but the reality is that it's not. It's health for all because this is what we all need. At the beginning of the pandemic, we've done a number of analyses that showed you that reducing by just 3 days the duration of the pandemic would repay for the investment needed to end the pandemic, to cover for the needs of low-income countries as well as high-income countries, just because of the cost of the slowdown of the economy. So it's clear from an economic standpoint, it's a message that needs to be conveyed more and more strongly, in addition to the fairness message that is still very present. And that's why conversations are shifting. When you talk about health security now, it's shifting to, you know, ministries of finance, that economic sphere, and not just development agencies.
You spoke about health inequity between countries, but I think it's fair to say that it exists within countries and even within high-income countries. And that's, to my mind, been exposed by COVID having that disproportionately high impact on certain racial and ethnic groups, those on low incomes, and the vulnerable.
Absolutely. I think we've seen that, and it's something that is becoming a more and more a hot topic these days. I think we've heard it a lot about like geography in the past, but now it's becoming really obvious because we have data to demonstrate it about some minorities or ethnic groups that have more limited access to some products or receive different services and health services than others. There's a conversation also about gender and how women don't have the same access to health products than men. It's been exposed by COVID, I think, because we had a lot of data and it was a hot topic, and just the access and the coverage rate that we were reaching for was really top of mind for everybody, and we were all looking at those numbers. What I found super interesting is that it's been the core of what global health institutions have been working on. And when I say global health institutions, I mean international institutions like, you know, the World Health Organization, like the Global Fund, philanthropies like the Gates Foundation, like, you know, a number of other foundations, implementers on the ground, countries, etc. So this whole global health ecosystem has been working hard for the past 15, 20 years in improving access to innovation for low middle income countries, trying to resolve exactly the same barriers as the one that we are seeing in high income countries and in all settings. The reach, the accessibility, the adaptation of the product to the user's needs. It's about affordability, of course. So those barriers that we've seen in low middle income countries are exactly the same as we have in high income now.
In your experience and your role and speaking to all these different players in this ecosystem, as you call it, what are the big stumbling blocks to finding a solution?
I think first, we've made a lot of progress. HIV, for instance, there was a 15-year gap between the moment where we had, you know, ART in high-income countries and the moment where the products were brought in low-middle-income countries and started bending the curve. 15 years. If you think of the COVID vaccines, it was just weeks between the moment where we had the first vaccines in high-income countries and then we got the vaccines in low-middle-income countries. Of course, the coverage rates are different and we're not there and there's a lot of progress to be made. As long as everybody is not fully vaccinated, we won't be able to say it's fully a success. But it's a huge progress compared to the situation we were in. And that's because we've built off all of that experience and been able to accelerate access to innovation. So we won't solve the problem in 15 years, maybe, but there's still a lot that we can do. But it's a lot that requires all the ecosystem working together. Access is about supply and demand. You need to have the product and you need people to want the product and to be able to get it. There are millions of things that you need to do at the same time. And that's why it's a bit daunting for a single organization to try and address that, whether it's a pharmaceutical company or whether it's a government, because it's really an ecosystem play. If you're a single company trying to address it, it feels like whack-a-mole a bit. You feel that you're alone trying to, you know, fight against all of those things, where in fact, it's more a Velcro strap that you try to unscratch, and you need millions of things to work at the same time. You need to work on the product, on the price, on the regulatory aspect, on the adaptation, you know, at country level, on the supply chain. You need to work on culture. You need to work on all of those things.
Of course, it goes without saying that this isn't just about economics. Of course, it's about people's lives. And, you know, fairness naturally has to play in, but it's just talking about how we can make progress in the next 15 years. Will it take 15 years to get to where we want to go? Will it take even longer?
I wish I could tell you how long it's going to take. And I wish I could tell you that it's going to be resolved. It's a long journey. There are targets to close the gap on well-known pandemics, on TB, HIV, malaria, maternal and child health immunizations, which are like the usual suspects that the community has been working on for years. That would already be fantastic. But things like COVID and things that happen are putting a setback to these things. And then there is another wave of conditions that we need to address. So if you're thinking of oncology, for instance, the prevalence of cancers in low-income countries is significant as well. And in high-income countries in, you know, in a number of places. But we need to work significantly on understanding where we're missing patients and what is the bottleneck, and solving that by combining a new vision of the product. Well, so we need to get the science right and making all the progress that is underway. That's one. Once we know how to do that, we need to get the protocols right to fit the patient needs and to fit the needs of the health systems in those places, and then make it affordable and accessible to the people who really need it. So even when we're done with the usual suspects and the big killers, then there is a second wave of like the chronic disease and, you know, the non-communicable diseases and all of that. I don't want to say it's never ending, but it's going to be a long journey.
Very diplomatic. You said there that COVID has held us back in some regards, but do you think it's spurred pharma, indeed the whole global health system, governments, the public, to pursue actionable efforts towards reversing health inequity?
At least in the conversations that I'm part of, I feel a different momentum than, you know, a few years ago. It's a combination of raising awareness on equity in general and the fact that there are different groups who have access to, you know, equity at work, equity in health, equity in education, a number of things. So raising awareness that we need to solve the inequities in general in our society, that's one. And then applied to health and the impact that it has on economy. I think that's the thing that COVID's put spotlight on. And if you combine those things, I see a clear momentum to improve, make progress, take action to solve health inequity in all settings, high-income settings, low-income settings alike. You know, and learning from everything that has happened in the past years in low-income settings to use that to improve situation in high-income settings as well.
Johanna, thank you so much. And thank you for listening. We'd love to know your thoughts. To get in contact, leave us a message at thesowhat@bcg.com. And if you like this podcast, why not hit subscribe and leave a rating wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.